A podcast of the Cinnabar.
Starring Alonzo Duralde.
And Dave White. And our special guest
this
week.
We just said each other's names. Yes. If this is your first time, I'm actually Dave White.
And I'm Alonzo Duralde. And joining us this week from Variety is friend of the program. We're thrilled to have him back. Peter DeBruges is here.
Hello,
thank
sir.
You guys.
We missed having you on our year-end wrap-up, which you often have appeared on, but you had other festival fish to fry.
Right, that broke sort of a tradition of ours.
I know. And then you saw a lot more at Sundance than I did, and I thought I did kind of a crappy job of
recapping
the festival.
You're permanently out
so.
Now.
Oh, no.
you're done.
Well, you know, I went kind of rogue on my top 10 list this year, and it's almost more appropriate to the Sundance conversation.
Oh, really?
Because I put The Writer as my number one film of the year, as did, you know, it was nominated for Best Picture by the
Spirit Awards.
Spirit Awards, you know, for four nominations in different categories. But, and I figured, like, why wait, you know, another year to promote this film that had made such a splash at Cannes and has played other festivals? But, you know,
this is the Chloe Zhao film that's going to open in
April. Sony Classics has it. It was in the spotlight section at Sundance. You know, it's been at Telluride in Toronto and many festivals. It won the Reykjavik Film Festival when I was there, and
it's the one that if you looked at the Spirit Award nominations, you're like, what?
What is that movie?
Although, if I can plug it for a second, I mean, like, this is like the great American story. I think. I mean, it's for me, it was last year's Moonlight in the sense of it's a movie that shines a light on a, you know, a small kind of a microcosm that we wouldn't see otherwise, except by grace of this filmmaker. And you know, Chloe Zhao, who is Chinese born, you know, schooled at NYU, went to a Lakota Indian reservation where she made her first film, Songs My Brothers Taught Me.
Yeah.
And while she was there, she discovered this, you know, Lakota teenager who has like star potential and who is a rodeo rider. And this is what he does, you know, that's his passion, except he was thrown from a horse, had his head stomped on, nearly died, has a metal plate in his head.
Ooh.
And if he's been told if he ever rides again, if he falls, he is likely to die. And so here is a story of a 17-year-old who everything he cares about in life is riding horses,
right,
who can't do that one thing. And it's like a football player who gets a, you know, life-threatening concussion. It's like a boxing player.
It's like the guy in The Fast and the Furious who has to take the bus to work.
Right, exactly.
way to take something very serious.
No, what I love about that is you've just expanded the audience for this movie 1,000%.
I'm just trying to put it in terms that people can understand.
Right. I mean, but the stakes are life and death. Yes. You know, it takes place in a... And I love the idea that the cowboy versus Indian tradition, basically you fast forward to the present day and the Indians are carrying on the cowboy way of life with this, you know, rodeo thing.
Right.
It's great, you know.
So, yeah, we'll be talking about that when it opens in a few months.
Will you be making a Fast and a Furious joke then?
I can't say. Maybe
Mr. Smart Mouth
maybe,
person.
Maybe I will.
It is the writer, R-I-D-E-R.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so anyway, so we missed getting to have you talk about Best of the Year, but you did take a deep dive into Sundance, so we'll be talking about that later on. We'll kind of wade through the fairly slim pickings of this weekend. I guess it's Super Bowl weekend, so they don't open a lot.
His experience at Sundance first, or
we could do that.
We can come back to it. You guys
get all the film festival-y stuff out of the way, and then we'll talk about the releases of the week.
All right. Well, so last week I talked about a handful of films that I saw, Blind Spotting and the Jane Fonda and Robin Williams docs, and Ophelia and Skate Kitchen.
Lonzo took it easy.
I did. I did an old man Sundance, you know. Well, it was literally that thing where it would be 11 o'clock at night and I'd seen a bunch of movies all day. And I was like, okay, I could either write two reviews now or I could get a night's sleep skip the 8:30 a.m. screening and then write them in the morning. And I opted for the latter.
Yeah.
I took it even easier because of not going.
Yeah, and believe me, I was envious.
But, I will say, you and I are of different minds on blind spotting, which for me is...
I'm in the minority. Everybody is way more into that movie than
I mean, I haven't talked to enough people, to be honest. I mean, this was a very sequestered Sundance for me because, you know, Variety sent one fewer critic, and so we were all kind of like pulling greater weight.
Dividing,
you know,
and conquering.
But which sort of made sense in was a quiet Sundance. I disagree with people who say it was a weak one.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I do think, you know, part of that is judged counterintuitively by, you know, how much people pay for these movies. And
exactly.
All this kind of stuff.
And Jacqueline from Black Girl Nerds wrote a piece for IndieWire saying that this was actually a really strong Sundance about women and people of color, which is why a lot of the sort of traditional, not only like distributors, but pundits were like,
This was a major Sundance about reputation, representation.
Mm-hmm.
I will say further that Sundance has been leading that charge for decades.
Sure.
And there was a Sundance maybe 5 years ago where half of the competition films were directed by women, for instance. And, they just are ahead of the complaint that so many other festivals get about, you know, not being inclusive. And, that's something, you know, Chloe Zhao is someone who comes out of the Sundance labs when she was developing songs my brothers taught me.
As did our friend Sandy Tan, who did Shirkers, which I'm dying to see. But,
me too. I missed that, yeah.
But just didn't because I knew I couldn't review it, you know, so...
I sort of had to, give short shrift to the documentaries this year because of the, you know, just...
Being understaffed.
The smaller team. But, that said, it's like... I do think that this was a rare year in which the narratives were stronger than the documentaries. And so many people come out of Sundance every year being like, you know, gosh, the competition was kind of, you know, unimpressive, but I just saw so many great documentaries. And here I just saw, you know, at least half a dozen really strong movies. You know, some I didn't love, but are really juicy or worth, you know, sinking your teeth into. Like The Tale is a good example of...
I've been hearing good things. Yeah, tell us about that one.
Well, The Tale is Jennifer Fox's sort of... She's a documentary filmmaker who won Sundance's Grand Jury Prize 30 years ago.
Wow.
For a documentary called Beirut,
okay.
I believe. And this is before my time, and I don't know that film, but she's back now making her first narrative, and it's an autobiographical investigation. I wish it had been more in the Stories We Tell mode. Is that the name of Sarah Polley movie? I love
yeah,
so much. Yeah.
Where everyone plays themselves or whatever?
You know, it's this kind of unreliable, you know, investigation into her own past.
Mm-hmm.
And she misremembers. Laura Dern plays the Jennifer character in the movie as an adult, but she misremembers basically her own deflowering as this kind of romantic thing with an older man. And it turns out as she discovers a story she wrote when she was 13 years old that she turned into like an English class and got a grade on, and you know, the teacher kind of questioned like, just your imagination, right? Like, otherwise, you know, basically about this very
special... Do I need to call the authorities?
Yeah, like this beautiful, you know, love story she had with her running coach, you know, played by Jason Ritter, and the kind of horseback riding instructor. And they sort of colluded to, you know, seduce her when she was 13.
Oh.
Played by an 11-year-old actress. There's some weird details about the provenance of this movie. I think it was shot like 4 years ago. It was submitted to Sundance a year earlier and turned down. It's like she's been working on this a lot. And you can tell that it's kind of a mess, but it's really interesting in the way that it, you know, has the character kind of, you know, play a memory and then replay it as she revises and unearths kind of like, you know, the truth about what happened. And it, you know, kind of builds to a big confrontation with her attacker. Which, of course, like, had it been accepted at Sundance a year ago, it might have just kind of, like, come and gone. But, like,
right.
In the moment, the
sure.
Me Too moment, this is,
right.
Like, so directly plugged into that conversation. And I think the conversation around this film is so much, shows so much greater potential than the film does itself. You know? It'll be great as it kind of, like, opens and unrolls on NPR and, you know,
right.
all the kind of, like, interviews that'll
It's messy but provocative.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay. All right, and what other narrative features grabbed you?
I mean, I will say, like, Blindspotting is as good a for me, it was as strong a film as I've ever seen at Sundance. I mean, it's like...
Really?
Absolutely.
Wow.
I mean, and for me, this is like as important a movie as like Do the Right Thing in terms of just like the way it plugs into contemporary conversations about race and gentrification and class and,
you know,
America today.
That's all in there. I think it is a movie that tries to address too much, and I think it does not stick the landing on radical shifts in tone.
It's one of the things I most liked about the movie is that it has this really kind of this is going to sound like a horrible insult, and whenever I bring up Tyler Perry, it like always, you know, backfires on me.
Right.
You know, but the one thing that I really respect in Tyler Perry movies that I think he gets is that life will take like these crazy emotional turns on you mid scene, right. You know? And I think that in a way, you know, this movie shares that, you know, where it's like the whole premise is, you know, that he's got 3 days left on his parole and any interaction, this is David Diggs's character.
Yeah.
Who's won a Tony as Thomas Jefferson in mm-hmm. Hamilton. He's a co-writer and co-star of this movie, and he's got 3 days left on his parole, and any interaction with the police officer is likely to get him thrown back, you know,
right.
in a slam or throw away the key kind of thing, or shot dead, you know, in the kind of
right.
climate, you know. And so you go from these very tense moments to ones that have, you know, joy and humor and, you know, romance and, you know, the discovery and conflict. And it's like it's all in 3 days, you know, kind of work, basically.
Well, I've also always been in the minority about Do the Right Thing, so, you know.
What have we ever discussed that?
Maybe not on the
show. You don't think Do the Right Thing is
I would need,
really awesome?
I would need to see it again. Right. When I saw it, I thought it was
fine.
Kind of a mess, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
But how have we never had this discussion?
I don't know.
We but can again, go there. I'm all for
no,
it.
No, look, I haven't... I saw this movie 29 years
ago.
Yeah,
so it might be a little unfair to like have you defend your reservations. Like,
I saw it one time, so I mean, you know...
In a similar way, that movie has this kind of like... this way that everything's amplified, pumped up, you know, kind of like it does weird tonal shifts. It's got these really colorful characters all kind of coming together and interacting. You know, I do think that there's a lot in common, even though this is no imitation. What it does have, another similarity is like if Spike Lee's movie is all about kind of like blowing up Bed-Stuy, this is a movie that, you know, really just takes Oakland as a character, and it's all about the way that, you know, Silicon Valley and newcomers are kind of moving in and forcing out the people who've lived there all this time. There were three movies about Oakland.
Yeah.
In Sundance. The other really remarkable one, did you see Sorry to Bother You?
I did not, but I've heard really good things.
I mean, this movie is as ambitious as they come. I mean, it's Boots Riley, who's a rapper, his first... you know, his directorial debut, he's really kind of like channeling Michel Gondry with these really inventive, you know, devices and really creative, you know, stylistic choices. There's, I want
Tessa really. Thompson's t-shirt that says the future is female ejaculation. Yeah, April was raving about that one on Who Shot You, so I definitely want to check that
out. I mean, the trade-off, or the compromise is... It is so ambitious that it cannot sustain, and the second half of the movie is just... It goes gonzo and gets boring, and I couldn't believe that as it became increasingly surreal that I just didn't care. There comes a point when, what's the lead actor's name?
He was Lakeith Stanfield.
Lakeith Stanfield, who's in like four movies at Sundance this year.
I mean, right.
You know, you know, he goes on a news program and he's like, I can't believe that everybody's blank, you know, big third act, you know, spoiler or whatever,
right.
And nobody cares. And I thought to myself, and neither do we. But I mean, it's just crazy where it goes. By the way, like, I am sensitive to spoilers on this movie, but McSweeney's published this screenplay like 2 years ago. It's in like their volume 28 or something like that. You know, I mean, it's the kind of movie that I don't know whether this was ever on the blacklist, but it's the kind of thing that you can imagine people saying this is never going to get made, partly because it's so politically engaged. It's, it is biting off as much as Blindspotting is, but for me, it kind of overreaches. But, I mean, God love them both for their ambition.
Yeah, no, I mean, my thing with Blindspotting, even though I think that it doesn't achieve everything it wants to do, there's a lot of great individual moments in it. There's a lot of really interesting ideas in it. And I want everybody involved to keep making movies. I just, you know, like, for example, like David Diggs gets this blistering rap at the end of the film. And in and of itself, I think it's really well written and performed. But the context by which it occurs in the movie, I didn't buy at all.
Okay.
That's a huge risk that they take in that moment. And I think that they pull it off, but it could be the moment that people check out, too.
Yeah.
You may have checked out earlier. I don't know. But add to that then a movie like Monsters and Men, you know, which is about a police shooting that is witnessed on a camera phone. And it's basically told through three different perspectives. The guy who recorded it, the cop who is conflicted about whether to, you know, kind of... to speak up about racism that he's seen in the force. This is a black police officer. Mm-hmm. And how memorable was it that I can't even remember?
The shooter himself?
Number
or the...
three. It'll come back to me. But like, okay. But what's unsatisfying about the film is just that like none of those stories, they're all kind of elliptical. They don't have resolutions. They kind of, you know, toe dip into... the idea that different people have different conflicts about, you know, something like this. And of course we know that there's nothing simple about, you know, the issue of how policing in the community works right now. I think, sure. You know, the nation's attention is on this, but for me it was a little too subtle, and everybody is kind of directed, all the performances are directed to be, you know, so kind of almost unexpressive that it really, you know, is just asking us to project all the meaning onto this, which, you know, is, you know, some movies are mirrors and some movies are windows. And this is one, you know, that is all about how much you bring to it and with that subject. And there was another movie called Monster.
Right.
That's, you know, an adaptation of a peculiar YA novel that's basically written in screenplay form.
Oh.
So it kind of, you know, is a natural
was
extension.
Was waiting to happen.
You know?
Right.
But, you know, this movie, it has some big stars, Jeffrey Wright, Jennifer Hudson, you know, neither of whom has a lot to do, but...
Oh, I did see that one.
Right, you know, it's like, I mean...
I saw it, I watched the screener after Sundance.
Which one is this?
And
I
completely forgot about that one. Yeah. Well, of course it was written as a screenplay because the lead character is a film student.
Exactly.
And that was part of what I hated about it was that he narrates the movie like it's a screenplay, and it's like
interior jail cell day.
Yes, yeah. It's so self-conscious and precious about that that it distances you from the actual story that's being told, me anyway.
The trade-off I would say is that because the novel is the same way, I mean, who wants to read that, you know, in a book form, but for a YA audience, I think that this becomes really interesting. I mean, it's kind of like The Outsiders or for today or something, you know, like that sort of way that S.E. Hinton would engage with, you know, a part of the youth experience that sometimes runs on the wrong side of the law or gets mixed up with the wrong crowd. And this is about, you know, a kid who we meet behind bars and who's kind of discovering as the audience is what his own role was in the fatal shooting of a bodega clerk.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, it really threw me because half of it takes place in a courtroom. The courtroom is literally black and white. Everyone's wearing shades of gray, you know. Mm. I mean, there are some choices that are very on the nosy with this movie, and yet the verdict really threw me. You know, it's like it made me kind of question, you know, my own position on this. And I think that that's something that...
The movie does flirt with a moral ambiguity, but I don't think that it... I don't think it either sets it up or resolves it in a particularly interesting way. Where at the end I was like, oh, okay, that happened. That's a cool idea. I wish they had explored it in a way that I found more...
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a compelling. Good start. It's a first film. It's, you know, like, there's a great, you know, lead performance from a young actor. I don't remember the actor's name.
Who's the attorney in that one? Is it Rebecca Hall?
Or? It's Jennifer Ely.
Jennifer Ely, yes, yeah. Okay. Yeah, who's great.
And I guess the other standout for me in competition was Eighth Grade, which is Bo Burnham's.
That was my 8:30 movie that I skipped, that you missed. But I heard it was great.
Well, this one's like, you know, A24 has it, which yes. is weird for a movie in, like that it has distribution in competition. It was produced by Scott Rudin, who produced mm-hmm. Lady Bird. Right. And there is overlap. You know, this is what's interesting is for a movie that is centered on a 13-year-old girl in eighth grade finishing up the last days of middle school, you know, it's... I remember quoting in my review, I couldn't spout the quote directly, but like, you know, someone described Sundance in Down and Dirty Pictures as being, you know, basically kind of like all these, you know, newbies making stories about how they lost their virginity. You know, it's like, I mean, year after year, that's these stories we kind of see. And the idea that Bo Burnham kind of has projected himself into a woman's skin is kind of a remarkable thing considering the kind of solipsism that you so often find with young filmmakers. True. You know? And there's something really poignant about this movie I mean, just given all the movies we've kind of seen set at that age group from Kids to, you know, you could just name all the kind of like cataclysmic, you know, sure. how far are they going to go kind of things. You're holding your breath about like just all the ways that this, whether it's sexting or drugs or, you know, like being taken advantage of or who knows what that could go wrong with this young girl. And it's, you know, the tension is there, but the empathy is so deep. And there's such a connection between her and her father in the movie. That's it's a really beautiful movie at the end.
It's been interesting to watch sort of the rise of Bo Burnham, because I remember when he was just sort of like making these goofy little YouTube
My
shorts.
Whole family thinks I'm gay.
Yes! Yeah. playing the piano, you know. I thought he was really hilarious. And of course, like, and he was sort of a YouTube person before the notion of a YouTube person became so obnoxiously toxic.
Right, that launched this whole kind of like musical / rap comedy career of his. And he's, you know, blown up pretty big. He was, you know, someone I put on our 10 comics to watch list years ago. And it's just weird when someone who's landed on one of Friday's other 10 to watch lists crosses over to directing.
Right. Well, I mean, because he's been part of the Apatow posse, right? Because he's in Funny People, like, doesn't he star in the sitcom that one of the characters is working on?
He's
or something?
Got a couple small roles in a couple Apatow movies, yeah. But everyone kind of like gets sucked into that orbit sooner or later. I mean,
this is true.
The I wasn't expecting a year ago that, you know, Kumail Nanjiani would have found such a champion in Apatow, but of course, right. The Big Sick, you know, is the product of that. And I think everyone this year was looking for another Big Sick, which is, you know, a movie that is indicative of representation, new kind of voices being
represented. But super marketable.
Yeah, but, you know, a very populist movie.
Well, that's always a weird thing about Sundances is that people expect to repeat whatever it was that happened last year, and every year winds up going in a different direction, and you know, and like the people who are trying to make another Big Sick, it's not going to be until next year that they actually finish it, you know?
Right. That's a great point. And it's also a point about, like, you know, last year Sundance people were searching for things that commented on Trump, but it's like, you know, he'd been inaugurated right. during Sundance.
Exactly,
you know, where
yeah. right.
where's the creative, you know, lead time needed to sort of have movies that do respond to that?
There was an interesting piece in The Wrap, though, about how in the wake of, like, The Birth of a Nation and I Love You, Daddy, and, you know, all these movies that people had spent money on and then, like, got were stuck with when, you know, scandal erupted, there was a lot of vetting this year to
I
make
bet,
sure
yeah.
that anything they picked up that, like, everybody involved was not, like, going to have some, you know, groping accusation waiting
sure
around the corner, you know.
That must factor when, like, there's bidding. And it'd be interesting to know if there's some, you know, could we go back and see some movie that, like, has red flags around it based on the fact that it didn't sell, you know? Like,
oh, that's
that,
true,
that
yeah.
could mean something, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm only speculating.
Of course, yeah.
This is not something I thought of 3 seconds before I said that. But the but on the documentary side, it's worth saying that there was this movie called Our New President, which is about...
How Russian TV covered the Trump election.
Exactly. And right. it's also like reactions on YouTube and stuff like that. And it's just kind of a hilarious 80-minute clip reel of just the... It reminds me of during the entire election, I was basically tuned into right-wing radio just to sort of understand what... Because we weren't having the same conversation that is the left and the right kind of sides. And so it was kind of interesting to... You know, to kind of hear what the beefs that the other side had with the Clinton family or this or that. You know, it's like all these conspiracy things. You know, just anecdotally, I remember this. There was that whole 10th anniversary thing for like WikiLeaks, where Julian Assange was going to come on, and we all thought he was going to drop some big bombshell. I think we all thought he was going to drop the Clinton emails that came weeks later. But so I stayed up until whatever it was, 1 at night or something, to tune into that. And the only podcast that was carrying it was like Alex Jones's site. And for some reason, there was some miscommunication about like when it was supposed to start, and so I ended up having to like sit through an hour of his chatter till the actual press conference,
dedication,
which was a big nothing. But I remember like that among the many takeaways was like, you know, things about like how the Clintons have left a trail of dead bodies behind. Fact. He would like say, he would punctuate everything with fact, and he'd be like, you know, Anderson Cooper is going to host the next debate. Fact. And like, you know, he's an operative for the, you know, the CIA. Fact. And these are all things that we've kind of like, you know, established. And I was just like, God, I'm learning all these new facts, you know, that I'd never heard before. But like, and so, you know, our new president was kind of the same way, where it's like, it just, you know, talks about all these, you know, kind of elements in the, for instance, here's a fact I didn't know, that like, you know, President Trump is someone who pulled himself up by his bootstraps from growing up in, you know, New York to
hard
being
scrabble.
A veritable Horatio Alger.
Clinton basically has, you know, any number of kind of pneumatic, you know, disorders that can be seen in her fainting and her coughing and like, you know, all sorts of weird. There's some clip that they kept playing where she crosses her eyes and some, you know, caught on camera doing that just to be goofy. And it's like as if she's maybe just senile or who knows what. the thing is kind of hilarious and quite kind of horrifying. And part of the horror of it all is realizing that there was an entire populace that had kind of been conned by its own state-run media to celebrate Trump's election.
Yeah, I mean, I think a thing that we don't talk about enough when we talk about the importance of a free press is, countries of state-run media, like, you know, the government establishes a narrative, you know, like, that's why later in life, like, Michael Jackson would only perform in countries like Turkey, you know, where there was never any mention in the press about whatever scandals were dogging him here or court cases or whatever else, because where there was a state-run media, it was all like, oh, yay, Michael Jackson, we love him, you know.
We are building a statue.
Exactly.
And also on opening night, there was another kind of the moment thing, which is Lauren Greenfield's Generation Wealth.
Uh-huh.
You know, she's the woman, photographer, really amazing.
She's in Queen of Versailles, right?
Queen of Versailles and Thin, and this is her third feature. And she's done shorts before, but this is basically something where she put together this huge retrospective of her career, a massive Fiden book that's like wrapped in gold and, you know, four inches thick and, you know, like, ironically kind of looks like it's, you know, some sort of huge gold bar, but it's all the photos that she had kind of combed through over the course of 30 years reflect plastic surgery and opulence and, you know, run amok and golden toilets and all the kind of weird things. You know, her first stuff was the children of Hollywood stars like Kate Hudson and her posse and, you know, these, and she kind of is presenting those photographs, but she's also revisiting her subjects and, you know, kind of using a very personal approach. Like The Tale, it's a movie that's as much about what is Lauren Greenfield's obsession with all this stuff. Yes. But her premise is that, you know, we are a culture poised on the brink of our own extinction if we've gotten to this extreme, which is, I'm not on board with the premise. I think someone who's selectively obsessed with this kind of
assumes that everyone else is obsessed too.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, no one I know is practicing the kind of stuff that she has gone out of her way to chronicle. So it's like this is not representative, but certainly there are some pretty foul extremes that, you know, she's one of the preeminent documentarians of, and to have her documentary photography complemented by audio recording she's been doing, you know, relationships she's kept with her subjects is, I mean, it's a really interesting conversation starter as well. 2 hours that, you know, feels like it could have been a Netflix series.
Wow. And those people all just got a giant tax cut.
Congratulations.
Hooray.
Yay.
For that.
Thank you to our new president.
any other sinusitis, or is that...
I'll throw one more out there. A documentary I love called Minding the Gap, which is, I think any documentary that spans like 10 years now, it's now described as the boyhood of this or that. So this is like the boyhood of skate videos or something. But which, I mean, like documentaries have, I mean, the reason Boyhood was remarkable is it did what documentaries have long done. And this is someone who, like, as a teenager was basically making skate videos with his friends. And as he became more and more interested in making real movies, he just had continued to record them. They're his two best friends, basically. His name is Bing Lu, and he's got like a white friend and a black friend. And he grew up kind of in an abusive household. So did his black friend. And the white guy, as he is getting older, is becoming kind of an alcoholic and kind of abusive to his own friends. And so in a way, this this portrait of these three friends as they grow older takes on this real profundity as they start to look at just this kind of culture of domestic violence. And the whole thing is quite remarkable. And the skate footage, which, I mean, this is not a genre I much care about, but like the fact that you've got a kid on his own skateboard keeping up is, you know, pretty awesome to begin with. So you've got, you know, these guys who, are kind of lower middle class, blue collar, type kids. And you're kind of seeing, what they grow up to be and kind of what the scar tissue that kind of comes out over time. You know, that movie got one of the special jury prizes in at Sundance, and from the stage, the guy who won the main prize gave a shout out saying, like, hell, that movie, Minding the Gap, was his favorite. I've been hearing that all week, so I caught it up with it like on the next to last day, and it's a really remarkable movie.
Oh, you went for the whole shebang.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow. Bitter end. Okay. Woo. Because it's Thursday to the following Sunday.
It's a 10-day stretch.
Yeah, I have never gone for the whole thing. I don't think I could take it.
I mean, with more than 100 world premieres, it's kind of necessary. We cover, the awards themselves, all these kind of things.
No, I totally get it.
But it's a long time to be away from my cat, who had hip replacement surgery in the middle of in the middle of Sundance. It was a crazy, it's not a story worth sharing here, other than like imagine
what show do you think you're on? Yes.
A digression?
Tell us about this.
I mean, like basically on day one of Sundance, my cat sitter, my old friend was taking the cat in to have this like $3,000 operation. Let this be a lesson to anyone who buys purebreds. Apparently, I have an Abyssinian who's the sweetest, smartest thing, but the trade-off is
the bones are fragile,
and it happens to dogs, I guess, too. It's like it's a known thing that nobody warned me about. But
I've always been a mutt person. So,
it's a bigger risk with dogs, I think. Something happens where basically the ball of their hip socket, joint explodes, and so he had to be opened up, replaced with like a porcelain prosthetic.
Poor thing.
Yeah, I mean, now he's running around like a quarter shaved. He looks like he's got a chicken leg in the back.
Well, and I didn't know this. I just saw somebody was talking about on Facebook recently. Pet insurance is a thing now.
Well, I mean, you can bet that I'll be getting it now. Even with a high deductible, it would have been nice to.
But of course, now you've got a pre-existing condition.
I'm less worried about this leg than should it happen to any other one.
No, I totally get it. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
Wow. What does a pet insurance do?
It's health insurance. It's health insurance for your pet.
Yeah.
So, like, if your cat suddenly has a tumor or something,
right?
Like anything else, you have a deductible, and then they cover the,
And I know so many people who, with their 12 or 15-year-old beloved animal is, paying for chemo or who knows what, some elaborate thing where, given American medical prices.
Yeah, when we were kids, I think people just put their pets down earlier. Right. And now it's I never heard about chemo for a dog until the last 10 or 15 years.
Our pets just went to live on a farm.
Exactly.
I mean, this is a 9-month-old kitten. It was the sweetest thing. I wasn't going to be like, sorry, we're going to start over with the...
Nor am I suggesting you should, but I'm just saying, I think the general way that we handle pets and their ailments has changed in the culture.
No doubt, and I'm couldn't have been that long ago when a cat with a shattered hip did something other than got a porcelain replacement.
Right.
You can't put, like, the wheeled thing on a cat, can you? Like, you know, dogs sometimes they get the hind legs, you know, they ride on the little wheel.
I remember when, you know, when I was first adopting a cat in L.A. a decade ago, you know, I was looking on Pet Finder. I wasn't looking at purebreds or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, I found this kind of cute, sad story of, like, a cat that basically had no hind legs and so was on one of those wheeled things and had, like, no bladder control. Like, the whole lower back was, like, a problem. So it had to be, like, in a diaper on wheels. And I remember showing it to my partner at the time, and he was like, it needs us. And I was like, you don't want that kind of dependency of, like, a, you know, a cat who's, like, basically poor lower kid. Body. It doesn't work, you know? Yeah.
No, it needs somebody really to take care of that. But that, you know, that's a lot to take on, for sure.
Yeah.
Anyway.
How would you get... I'm trying to think of, like, how you would allow that cat to get around your home. Like, you'd have to remove all obstacles.
Well, you'd have to, you'd have to block the staircase or whatever, you know.
Yeah, that too.
Yeah.
Like having a living Roomba.
Yeah, exactly. I was thinking...
going around.
That's the image I had.
Poor thing.
Okay, so... shall we move on from films that no one but film critics have seen
to stuff that's actually films in theaters that
no one's going to go see because it's a terrible horror movie called Winchester?
Oh yeah, so why not? Winchester, which I think Peter and I both had to, well, I guess you didn't. I assigned a review out of London because the UK critics got to see it in advance, whereas American ones didn't.
Lucky them.
Yeah.
Right, occasionally a big assignment will go there. Like, for instance, you know, 50 Shades Freed will open in Paris on Wednesday.
Yeah,
before it screens for critics in the U.S., so we'll send someone to Paris to catch it.
Yeah, no, I had to track down a stringer in Paris to cover it. And it's like...
this used to be my gig, by the way.
Oh,
my,
yeah, you were the guy in, like, Paris, yeah.
Hey, because I'm in Paris, like, send those 50 Shades of Grey my way. But now we have to arrange a...
And which is completely ridiculous, because the studio could just decide to show it to us before the Paris premiere, but they don't want to.
Right.
So, anyway.
Well, I mean, you've seen the other two movies. Right. You know why they aren't doing that.
I suppose.
Right, so that's Universal's solution, is like, maybe we'll, like, maybe it'll hurt less if a freelancer pans it or something.
Yeah, or like the French stringer, yeah, the true.
Or maybe they'll be kinder, who knows? I mean, it kind of backfired on them with Peter, this was Sony and Peter Rabbit, you know, today, where it's like, they let us see it a day before the embargo lifts, and then it all
most
kind
people
of,
hated it.
Yeah. It all melts down. But.
So, yeah. So, Winchester. It stars Helen Mirren as an actual person, Sarah Winchester, the heiress to the Winchester Repeating Arms company.
And the premise is actually also...
based in reality.
Real, yeah.
She has this house in San Jose that is now a tourist site that she kept adding on to and... putting rooms and hallways to nowhere and whatnot.
To appease the spirits of people killed by...
Winchester products.
Winchester products.
Now that's an interesting...
that's the movie's premise. Do we know if that's why she did it in real life?
I did a little homework. Okay. Apparently that's why she did it. Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah. A cool idea. Because, you know, it's a real-life ghost story in a real-life haunted house. And, you know, sort of touches on the whole gun issue.
Okay,
you know?
Wait a second. Real-life haunted house.
Okay, sorry. Let me back up. Real life house that is purported to be haunted.
That is correct. Nothing like a terrible ghost story movie to make me
believe even less.
Revisit the paranormal. One of my favorite jokes, which is, how do you know if you have a ghost in your house?
Answer:
you don't.
Ooh. After we talk of Winchester, let's go back to Hereditary.
Oh, I was going to ask if you saw that. Okay,
but we'll come back.
We will circle back. So this is directed by the Spierig twins.
Yes.
They did...
are they twins or are they just brothers?
Well, you saw that Thanks for Coming to the Movies thing with me. Didn't they look like twins?
No, I closed my eyes during that because I don't need... here's what I don't need. That damn new trend of someone from the movie popping up before the movie starts...
and thanking
me for coming and telling me... we all worked really hard on this film.
Yeah, what's really...
That is literally what they say.
It is true. And what's stupid about this one is that they actually show behind-the-scenes footage of, like, people on wires getting yanked back. And it's like, don't give away the gimmicks of the horror movie you're about to show me.
Yeah.
Like, let me be surprised that, you know, somebody gets yanked off their thing, and I'm not, now I'm going to be thinking about the wires.
Little clips of Helen Mirren going, throwing her head back and laughing, like, ah, ha, 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 we're having such a good time making this film. Meanwhile, the whole film is her doing this. Ghosts.
No, this, I don't know if you've seen this, Peter. A lot of times lately, if you go to a movie, especially on opening weekend, but I've had them do it at press screening sometimes, there will be this pre-recorded thing with, like, the stars of the film or the director of the film or some combination.
Maybe Schumer and Goldie Hawn, for example.
For Snatched, you know.
The people from the Emoji movie,
for example.
Yeah, and they're like, we thank you for seeing this film the way it was intended to be seen. And, I mean, it's literally, like, at the very end, please keep coming to movies, you know.
I will say that, like, having now done a few recent reviews out of movie premieres like Black Panther, like The Last Jedi, you know, it's like that whole pre-roll thing of, like, you know, the red carpet and all this kind of, like, this stuff. Like, at The Last Jedi, I realized, like, this is a really idiotic omission or oversight to have had, but, like, I gave away a big character reveal in the movie, and it never occurred to me that it was a spoiler. Twist, partly because, like, Frank Oz walked the red carpet and was, like, there on stage, and, like, you know, don't ghostly past Jedi show up in all Star Wars movies? Anyway, I mean, that was a pretty major thing to kind of let the audience at the premiere know before the premiere shows.
You know? Yeah, because like at the Black Panther premiere, it's again, they are projecting on the screen what people who are watching the red carpet or the purple carpet in this case at home are seeing online. Yep. And so when they're like between interviews, they'll roll all these clips from the movie or they'll roll like junket interviews with the people talking about the movie. And it's like, I'm about to see the movie. Could you shut up? I don't want to know this stuff.
Your favorite thing in the movie? They ask Rian Johnson, and it's like, I'm pretty sure it's like from the last 10 minutes of it. You know,
So we sit through that stupid Winchester intro with the Spearigs who may or may not be twins. And then, yeah, Winchester, which is a stone cold bore.
Oh, no.
It's been a while.
You had gotten me interested just with the pitch, you know?
Yeah, that's the thing. It all on paper, this seems like it could be interesting. I have not had that hard a time keeping my eyes open at a screening that I was seeing for my job in quite a while.
God, that would be a fun game to play.
Well, I used to be.
What would that be for me?
I used to be a real hardcore right-wing NRA member until Thursday night when we saw Winchester, and then they bored me into gun control. What was the film critic who called Jason Clark a walking potato?
That was Jason Solomons, who I sent for the rap.
Well, then. And I like that guy. He plays a psychiatrist whose job is to go to Sarah Winchester and have her declared
unfit
to be a contributing member of the board of directors.
It sounds like this year's Cure for Wellness.
Yeah,
like the February kind of elaborate, but
not nearly as stylish though.
So you goes and he starts testing her and, you know, interviewing her. But, you know, he realizes
the house.
Ooh, there's so many ghosts.
I was reminded yesterday that by a This American Life segment that was talking about something that as film critics we're really kind of like sensitive to now, which is like what the right and left won't let you say these days. You know, certain positions you can't have. And they interviewed this senator who proposed a kind of like a ban on imitation guns, which is like real that you can
like
shoot
realistic toy guns.
Well, not even that, like pellet guns and BB guns, things that don't involve gunpowder.
Uh-huh.
So it's not a firearm because it doesn't have gunpowder.
Right.
But and I was reminded, like, I was shot with a pellet gun on my school campus as a junior in high school. Like the seniors like had brought a pellet gun to school and were like picking on the nerds. Mm. And this was in Texas, and the kid got a day's suspension, and that was that. Like, no one ever, you know, followed up with it. There was no policy change. There was
Wait. You were a nerd?
Yeah, right. That was the twist in the story. Thank you for catching the, like, the surprise.
I got shot in the hip by a BB gun by a friend of mine once.
Yeah.
Thanks.
The fact that this happened at school, you know, is what kind of, like, right. blows my mind.
Well, and I suspect in a post-Columbine world, they would have been less lenient about...
No question.
...a gun on campus.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, in Texas, you never
even,
know. But
even
like,
in Texas.
In Texas, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, this crappy movie.
There's a kid in it who keeps getting possessed, and we know he's possessed because his eyes get all milky.
And because he sings the same... You know, Bicycle Built for Two, whatever the hell song it is.
No, it's...
Beautiful Dreamer.
Beautiful Dreamer.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that reminds me, did anyone see The Music of Silence that opened Friday?
No.
So, I'm reminded because of Milky Eyed People. This is the Andrea Bocelli.
Oh, yeah, biopic. No, thank you. They kept sending me screening notices about that. I was like, no.
You know what? I would watch that if only for the moment when he...
goes on Oprah?
He goes on Oprah and refuses to sing for her.
Oh, that is not, like, that's brilliant. Not in the story. This movie is an authorized vanity project based on his own memoir.
That's why I didn't want to see it.
Oh, really?
In which he, like...
Tell me more.
I mean, and it's
he cures cancer.
It's the story of how,
his voice.
You know, someone who's born with glaucoma loses his sight at 12. I didn't realize Andrea Bocelli is, you know, blind because I only listen to Andrea Bocelli. But the, and even then... Not a lot.
How often do you listen to Andrea Bocelli?
No, I mean, I like that kind of music. Okay. I love the Vienna Boys Choir. I love opera. I love, you know, the... you know, I have not found myself wondering, like, you know, what was it like for young 12-year-old Amos, you know, his fictional alter ego.
Oh, it's like, not even his name.
When
it's
you... Yeah, he's
okay,
written
have,
this kind of...
I have to go see this.
...novel. I mean, it's just like a turgidly boring, safe, toothless movie from Michael Radford, who has done good things before. He's the director of Il Postino and Merchant of Venice. You know,
I figured after seeing that awful, going back to James Corden, the
Paul Potts.
The Paul Potts biopic.
Oh,
I was done with that.
I really, the way movies handle people who sing operatically is just really funny to me.
Well, another issue here is, like, so all of the opera is dubbed by Bocelli, right? And yet...
So at 14, he's already...
Well, and they have to sing a little Untrained earlier on. I'm not entirely sure if the early stuff, but, like, the... but all of the dialogue is in thickly Italian-accented English. And it's just like, if you're going to dub one, dub the other. You know, it's like... why make these people sound like... I mean, the problem with the whole accent thing...
Is it like that sort of like spicy meatball kind of offensive Italian English?
No, it's more just kind of like, you know, them doing their best, but, you know, having...
non-English speakers.
Right. I mean, having all, you know, foreign actors doing this, and you wonder why. I mean, it's not the same thing as, say, like, The Zookeeper's Wife, where... The risk of having Jessica Chastain play with a Polish accent is that she sounds like a Polish housekeeper. Like, you know, an educated Polish woman could probably speak without the thick accent.
Oh,
know?
Right.
But it's, so there's this weird, you know, kind of paradox that happened. Here it's just kind of like, why don't you just let these people act in their native language, which is clearly Italian?
I'm sure.
Set in Italy.
Probably,
you know?
I'm sure the financiers were like, it's got to be in English.
Except this movie was like a big hit in Italy, where Bocelli, you know, did the whole San Remo. He was like the highest scoring first timer ever to perform at the San Remo Music Festival. He's a local hero. That movie's done well there.
He's their ABBA.
Zero here.
Yeah, no, it's barely getting released here anyway. But but speaking of singing, just the this kid in the movie who is, you know, the plays the,
you know, he's got a ghost inside him because he keeps singing this old timey song over and over.
Yeah, but but also he has this really unfortunate bright red bowl cut, and because he is afflicted, he spends much of the movie in like a nightshirt, so he looks eerily like Annie. I kept waiting for him to bust out the Hard Knock Life. You know,
nice.
it's like, and every time he comes on screen, you know what's going to happen. You know his eyes are going to roll back and it's going to be milk and he starts singing Stephen Foster and like creepy stuff is going to happen. You know,
it's like, it's too bad sometimes these movies aren't more popular just because then Saturday Night Live would come up with a really easy, great parody.
Yeah, the mocking is just sitting right there. But yeah, no, I think it won Friday, but it's going to fall to Jumanji.
Nothing in it makes any... It doesn't even make ghost sense because she hammers 13 nails into all the doors to keep the ghosts in the rooms.
She's
and
recreating
like,
the rooms they died in, and that's supposed to allow them to pass into the next world, but right. sometimes they don't, so they have to nail 13 nails into the door to keep them trapped until they are ready to leave.
Why 13? It's just the
Winchester 13. It's a spiritual it's in the Bible. Number or something. I don't know.
Okay.
The movie barely explains, if at all. And, but you know, it's like you're thinking, well, ghosts just go. If you're, as I said on KCRW with Madeline, if you're such a ghost, you should be able to walk through that wall. You don't have to stay in that room just because she nailed you in there.
You know, here's an interesting thing. So, like, I have a colleague, Maggie Lee, who's our Asian chief critic. And, you know, she and I had this conversation once about how, like, all those Asian ghost movies don't really do it for me. Like, yes, there are jump scares and whatever, but I'm not afraid of ghosts. You know, I don't believe in them.
Right.
You know, she was like, well, Peter, you know, the you Americans have all these, like, serial killer movies. Like, the chances of me being attacked by a serial killer are way lower than the ones of me being attacked by a ghost. And I was like, that is true that, like, culturally I'm really afraid of serial killer movies, you know? And it's like, and I'm suspicious in real life of people being a serial killer. And it's like, and you follow that line, you know, further. Like, you know, I was talking to my friend Julia, who works with Agnes Varda, when she came, you know, for Agnes's big honorary Oscar. And she, on the plane, she had watched Midnight Special, you know, which has this whole kind of, like, extraterrestrial third act. And she was like, you know, the movie, you know, seemed all right, but, like, I just don't understand what it is with you Americans and these alien movies. And I was like, what do you mean that's American? And she was like, yeah, like, Area 50. Like, there's no other country on Earth that tells alien stories.
Right.
It is a purely American, you know, concept. And it was like, somehow that is, you know, something that had never occurred to me. But
are we counting Solaris? Or is that, are those ghosts? I can't remember.
Right, that's sort of more of a science. But, like, I'm glad that you came up with an example, you know, like maybe Stalker or something, you know, the would have elements, you know, there too. But it's like, but it is like, it's this whole fear of aliens and belief in aliens is a very American thing. And we sometimes forget about these.
Well, and I always thought that be like, we have a friend who works in theme parks, and there's apparently, like, for the ones in Asia, they don't do ghosts. Like it's either, I can't remember if it was sort of verboten or just, like, not kind of a culturally acceptable thing. Like, the Haunted Mansion had to be completely sort of reconsidered from the ground up because you're not supposed to do ghosts.
And well, it's also really controversial to depict suicide and to acknowledge that in stories because it's catchy, you know, over there. I mean, this is probably really mischaracterizing the issue, but, like, I mean, like, there's a real risk of if you go there with your stories that it's going to give people ideas or something like that, you know. It is interesting how, I mean, Hereditary, the movie I mentioned.
Yeah, so tell me about, because that's everybody's been freaking out about Hereditary. They put out a trailer that everybody's just, like, dying to see this movie.
I mean, the movie is fantastic. It's a slow burn kind of, you know, horror movie with, it's more of a kind of, like, demonic cult kind of thing. You know from the beginning that the grandmother in this family who just passes away in the opening scenes is part of some sort of strange, you know, conjuring group. And, you know, her, Toni Collette, in the best performance I've ever seen her give, is in, you know, the first 45 minutes of the movie or so, really dealing with the grief and all the complicated reactions to this, you know, mother she had a conflicted relationship with, processing that. And it just, I mean, things get worse for her and she has more to kind of process. But, you know, that all is really rich and interesting to me. But once, you know, spirits start to manifest, and there's this, you know, kind of device that occurs where a shadowy character will appear in the background of a scene and the character seems unaware of it and whatever. And, you know, there's a part of my brain that's like, okay, let's say I believe in ghosts. Like, why is this a bad thing? If they're all mourning their dead relatives, like, wouldn't it be nice to, like, have that person, well, you could play chess, you know, like, you could get that hug that your, you know, mom always denied you. I don't, like, who's, why do you think it's going to strangle you, you know, the, and then the movie gets really freaking, you know, kind of, I would say a little bit like the way Kill List did. It just goes to a really kind of, like, wretched place. I just mean, like, in terms of, like, you know, putting its fingers deep into dark places of your brain and poking things you don't really want to be, you know. And I might be overselling it in that, like, I do think that it's effective, but at the same time, the ending is the least interesting part to me. It's more the, like, the slow burn buildup.
Gotcha.
And a couple twists along the way that, like, just really throw you for a loop of, this can't go where I thought it was going to go. It just did something irreversible, you know?
Yeah. But, well, not like the movie Irreversible.
Thankfully, not like that movie.
Just checking.
Okay, so the end of Winchester.
Yeah.
There's nothing.
Even Helen Mirren looks bored.
Yeah, if you think you want to see it just because Helen Mirren is in it, you do not.
No.
Because she has, again, absolutely nothing to do except walk around in that admittedly really cool looking black dress and say, I can feel it. I can feel the spirit.
It's all, her outfit is so.
She catches a ghost at one point. She kind of goes, whoosh, and her arms fly in the air. And you're like, okay, that was reasonably interesting.
It is such an old school cloak of mourning that she almost looks like a Harajuku girl. At one
it
point.
Wishes.
She's just the veil and the corset and the hoops and the, you know.
Somebody involved in that production saw the most recent, you know, mini wave of Hammer films and thought, I can make a cool, old-timey, boring horror movie. And
I'll put a woman in black.
And I'll put a woman in black.
It sounds like they should have hired, like, a Korean director. I mean, like, you know, they were doing that for a little while, and it's like...
It's
a big snooze.
So tedious.
By the way, like, post-Hereditary, you will never hear again without it making you think of that movie. There's, like, in the way that you talk about, like, the little kid who, like, you know, sings songs or whatever in his bowl.
Well, all right. I'm with you. I'm more scared of serial killers than ghosts.
Yeah.
Because there are actual serial killers. They live in places.
An effective ghost story can be scary, even if I rationally know the ghost.
There are good ghost stories.
The Haunting,
The Conjuring. Of course, yeah.
I was just going to say, the thing I can never shake is...
Right. I'm not saying there are no good ghost movies that are frightening. But
you're just not inclined to be.
You got to work double time.
I think the most effective horror movies tell us what we're afraid of, and because I'm not personally afraid of ghost movies, it kind of has to be about something else. And Hereditary works because it's as much about, you know, this idea of kind of like losing loved ones and you know, all the kind of emotional frazzle that brings on, and the place that puts you in.
So before we get into the happier news of two of the Best Foreign Film nominees, one of which is opening in theaters and one of which has hit Netflix, I completely forgot to talk about Forever My Girl, because it's a movie I've completely forgotten about for the most part.
And I keep confusing the title.
Yes, I was going to call it Forever Your Girl, and that's one of the better Paula Abdul songs, but no. It is...
This is the Paula Abdul version of that Andrea Bocelli film.
If only.
It's about a girl named Petunia who wants to be a fly girl. She wants to choreograph Janet Jackson videos, and she gets her wish.
I would see that movie. It feels like a Christian movie, only there's no Jesus in it. Or barely any. I mean, like, the lead character is a preacher's kid, but, like, people drink, and there aren't, you know, horrible, you know, circumstances around it. It's basically about a guy, small town guy, who leaves his girlfriend at the altar to become a country music superstar. As it happens, you know.
But that's a plot of Coco.
Yeah, kind
right.
of.
Yeah.
And so then years later, he's like burned out on the road. He comes back home.
His parents forbid the family from listening to or playing music.
He breaks into the cemetery. No, this is the kind of movie where it's like the, you know, idyllic white Hallmark Channel small town, but like the lead two characters have. Like, the guy has the one black friend and the girl has the one black friend. And, of course, they get married. Anyway, male black friend dies. So the guy comes home for the funeral to see his, like, disapproving father, who's played by John Michael Higgins, and his former fiance, who has a child who's just the right age. And it turns out, oops, he didn't know that she was pregnant when he left her at the altar.
But no one told him.
Nope.
You mean they had been having premarital relations?
I know, right? Apparently, preacher father flies to Seattle for his first show to tell him, but like the he was so wiped out on drugs or alcohol or whatever that there was no talking to him. And the movie never quite decides whether or not
email.
The movie,
is there email in this movie?
No. The country singer actually carries around this battered old cell phone so that he can still listen to the one message that the that the girlfriend left him. That's a recurring thing in the movie.
You're selling me on this movie.
And the movie's very vague about whether or not the country singer is an alcoholic or not, but
it sounds so Nicholas Sparksy.
It is down to the battered pickup trucks, but there are no ghost wives this time. Anyway, so he comes home, and is he going to stay and be a real dad to the kid and rekindle with the woman who was the girl from Happy Death Day, or is he going to go back on the road, blah, 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 blah. It's nothing. It is a nothing movie. And the songs aren't particularly good either.
Mm.
Great.
Good, you've unconvinced me.
Yeah.
Don't $12 saved.
My don't idea bother. Of it being the Paula Abdul story is
much better.
Better.
And it's funny because it is written, directed by a female filmmaker. And, you know, there's been a lot lately about, like, I'm, you know, 50, hashtag 52 films by women and all that stuff. And I'm like, and here's evidence that, like, we need to give more mediocre female filmmakers the opportunity to make as many mediocre films as their male counterparts.
At Sundance, did you see Come Sunday, the Netflix movie that Joshua Marsden directed?
I did not.
I'll make this really quick, but like, just I think of it because of the Christian reference. It's like it's set in the evangelical community and is centered on a This American Life report of a evangelical bishop who had kind of a change of faith.
Oh, I heard about this. Change it's of country. Chiwetel Ejiofor. Yes.
And I think this is, you know, arguably his best performance. It's not a big, you know, fiery one, but he's charismatic in the pulpit, but it's really about introspection and like, how does someone who has believed that, you know, the only way to heaven is through being saved, reconcile that with, in this case, the turning point is kind of like he is watching a program about like the Rwandan genocide and mm-hmm. all the casualties there. And is like, you know, how can God possibly let all those people die? And he just has this, he believes that he has communication with God that tells him that maybe, you know, you don't have to be saved, you don't have to be Christian to get into heaven, and that makes him, you know,
question everything,
ostracized by his, you know, his entire community, and he has to go and, you know, join in a Unitarian church. But long story short, what I love about the movie is, considering how important faith is to so many people and how difficult it is to depict that in a way that, you know, this is just really about, you know, a devout person's personal crisis. And like, Keith Stanfield is fantastic as like a composite character who's like the musical director of the church, mm-hmm. is gay, is HIV positive, and who is having a similar kind of, you know, would God abandon me kind of thing. And, you know, the movie's just really, I mean, Joshua Marsden doesn't come from this community, but had made the religious-sounding but deeply unreligious Maria Full of Grace,
right.
You know, that was at Sundance 14 years ago or something. But this is, you know, a movie that I hope it being on Netflix is actually a chance that it'll reach the right audience, because the audience, it's for people who don't go
to Christian movies.
Yeah, pay for movies in theaters, but like, you know, might check out something that's, you know, actually really, you know, really nuanced and sensitive. It's not doing that thing that, you know, the Sundance winner, Miseducation of Cameron Post, about gay conversion therapy is basically, you know, attacking Jesus freaks or something. And it's like that, you know, it's just, it's a preaching to the choir kind of movie, whereas one that deals with the richness
raises the complicated religion issues.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I guess I'll be seeing that one.
I think that sounds like a Dave White needs to talk about movie when it airs on Netflix.
Especially if it comes from outside. Like you said, he's not from that world.
The director isn't, Marston. Yeah, right.
I'll be interested to see like how much good consulting he got done.
Well, I think it had a lot to do with, you know, the screenwriter whose name I don't recall, you know, spent a lot of time shadowing
Marcus Hinchey.
Right. Yeah. He spent a lot of time shadowing the subject. And
I see.
This is based on This American Life story. Then obviously they went in deep with the guy.
You know? That preacher who's, maybe you have it on your computer, but like, I forget his name,
Carlton Pearson.
That's right, Carlton Pearson. Yeah. Like and there's a transformation just in the. Like,
oh my, Martin Sheen plays Oral Roberts,
which is a kind of great, you know, kind of a great. I mean, there's some fantastic supporting performances in this movie. You know, his wife is, you know, starts out as someone who's like just a an accessory, you know, like to make the bishop look like a family man and all these kind of things. I mean, it's not that it's insincere, but like, you know, he's devoted his entire attention to his faith and you know, the family life is secondary, but she finds a voice in it and she becomes really supportive of him after he, you know, makes this loner decision that Jason Segel plays, you know, the number two in his church as kind of like wingman. And I mean, it's like, this is a serious movie that, you know, is going to be buried on Netflix, and hopefully it's...
Oh, is that? It's going straight to Netflix?
Right. Well, I mean, that and the two theaters they open in.
Right,
For Oscar consideration.
In April, according to the site.
That really worked out for them on Bright, by the way. All the Oscar nominations.
Right.
Well, it did work for Mudbound, a little, but like not, like Oakjaw, right, got nothing, and Meyerowitz Stories got nothing. And
do you remember last year's Sundance winner, I Don't Feel at Home Anymore in This World with Melanie Lynskey?
Oh, yeah, that like immediately went to Sundance and nobody saw it or talked about
you
it.
You mean immediately went to Netflix?
I mean Netflix, yeah.
And the Gloria Allred documentary comes out this Friday. That's a Netflix movie that was in Sundance.
Okay. Yeah, no, there's a lot of very quick roller. I mean, last year there was Deidre and Lainey Rob a Train and like several Sundance titles. And yeah, I mean, unfortunately, this is sort of the new role of critics now. It used to be that, you know, we would alert people to like, you know, stuff in the art house that you weren't seeing. And now it's like, no, this is a thing on Netflix. You could be watching it right now, but you have no idea that it exists.
A friend reminded me that Icarus last year, a Sundance documentary about the Russian doping and everything, was purchased for $5 million by Netflix. That is like 1,000 years ago in terms of like this business. You know,
is that one of the nominated documentaries?
I mean, usually if you get a six-figure deal for a documentary, that's astounding. I don't know how they swung that. But
Well, speaking of Oscar nominees that went straight to Netflix and that need people to tell them that they exist, is the Hungarian submission to the Best Foreign Film Race, which y'all saw and I have not seen yet.
Yes. Ildikó Enyedi. I cannot pronounce her name.
My 20th Century, the director of My
20th Century. And also a film I love from 2000 called Simon Magus.
I haven't seen that.
Strange, strange sort of mystery film.
And this is her first film since then, by the way.
And this is her first film since then.
And it's called?
On Body and Soul.
It's about two people who share dreams.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is a great concept.
Oh, like Your Name?
It's not body swapping. Okay. You know, it's like it's more like they realize when they describe their dreams to each other at work, these two kind of like shy outcast types, that hey, I dreamt that.
Right. Hmm. So there's a man played by an actor named Jezza Morshanyi and a woman, Alexandra Borbelli, and she won some kind of award, best actress for this film over in the Europe. The Golden Bear at Berlin.
Yeah.
And so it is, you know, raking in the accolades. Anyway, he is a man who has shut himself down. He, for an unexplained reason, at least to my memory, has not the use of his left arm or hand. She is... They also never say the word autism, but she displays behaviors that would put her on the spectrum of behaviors associated with autism. She is incredibly precise and does not want to communicate with other people. She is a quality inspector in a meat processing plant. He is some other kind of white-collar worker in the same plant.
And she has this, like, weird... Like, you can tell that she's on the spectrum because she has, like... She's somehow had therapy. She goes to a therapist.
She goes to a child psychologist.
Yeah.
And even though she is an adult, she's been going to the same psychologist for her entire life. And every time she goes to visit him, he says, "Don't you want to see someone who works with adults now?" And she's like, "No. No, no. I know you." And then she won't leave him. But whenever she has a conversation, at work, she reenacts the conversation later with, you know, salt and pepper shakers or whatever, like in her own home, very much like children do in the offices of child therapists.
Or characters in, like, American independent films. Yeah. Like, it's like, it Sheena feels like Dunham. A 20 years she ago goes, Sundance movie.
Yeah, she goes, she has sort of stayed with what she knows her entire life, and it's not done in a cutesy way. It's not like, oh, these two salt and pepper shakers are talking to each other. Like, it's very much
her working out stuff.
Her working out stuff on a day-to-day basis. And her performance is really lovely. She's very precise and very melancholy. And she and he yearn for something else. They discovered that they are dreaming the same dream, where they are both deer in the woods. Not mating. They reiterate that over and over again. No, we are not mating in the dreams.
We're eating leaves.
Even though they are brought together because someone at the meat processing plant has walked off with this sort of hormone powder that they give to animals to make them mate. And there's a whole silly explanation as to why that powder is even in the place. Because they're not there to mate animals. They're there to dismember them and sell them off to, you know, supermarkets. But the juxtaposition of animals being slaughtered and, you know, encased in, you know, metal pens or, you know, eventually in styrofoam packaging versus the freedom of these deer. And it mirrors their own, you know, we're stuck in this stupid job that we don't like, and we wish we could be somebody else. Both of us wish we could be other people. And as we discuss these dreams with each other, we realize we are falling in love. I like this a lot. I like it a lot because it has the same sort of humane but off-kilter sort of sensibility that Simon Magus possessed. And I remember 18 years ago, seeing Simon Magus and thinking, oh, I hope to see more films by her. And then...
Yeah, and a lot of people feel that way about My 20th Century. You know, yeah. Like the, yeah. I mean, she's almost like a filmmaker from another generation who's had a hard time getting another project done.
Yeah, she's worked in a lot of Hungarian TV and documentary, but like features have not been, you know, quickly forthcoming from her.
Now they're throwing like Marvel movie offers at her.
Well, no, what I was going to say, I'm sure though, like if Hungary is one of those countries where, you know, filmmakers get grants from the government or whatever, like scoring an Oscar nomination is like, that's a good feather in your cap. Like,
and the Berlin win. I mean, like, this has put her back on the radar.
And I hope it does. I hope we do get to see more features from her, because I don't always know where she's coming from, but I like where she's coming from.
Gotcha.
The film itself is very cool and almost clinical, the way it looks. Because you think slaughterhouse, you think meat processing plant, and in film and television, those places are always super grody. You don't want to be there. But this place is almost...
gleaming?
Almost gleaming, yeah. It's a except for the moments where you actually see, because they shot it in a real place. Except for the moments where you actually see cows being de-cowed.
Which I think are like maybe the opening shots of the movie or something.
And it's like in the first 5 to 10 minutes. Yeah. And if you can make it through those scenes, you can go through the rest of the film.
It's not quite Prime Cut, the Gene Hackman.
No. It's
more like Our Daily Bread.
But you will flinch if you've never seen an animal undergo that thing, because they're showing you a real cow get turned into gravity.
Animals were harmed.
Did we talk about how, like, my problem with Okja is it just makes me hungry?
Yeah.
It's like, which is not the intention.
Yeah, I think the Flophouse Facebook group had a thing of like, which fictional animal would you want to eat? And I posted a GIF from Okja. People were like, oh no,
Free Willy. Like, those Icelandic people would love that. That
all pork three looked delicious. Animals from The Incredible Journey.
Babe. There.
You know, so the reason I couldn't do your podcast at the beginning of the year is I was at the Palm Springs Film Festival where we do our 10 directors to watch, and also where I moderate a panel with all the foreign language shortlist, so the 9 who have been at that point, including
right.
Inyeti. And she says that now that, like, you know, she has this attention again, she hopes to get her next project made, which the main character is a tree.
Okay.
I can't wait.
Well, then she can cast Judi Dench, who loves trees. You know, there's a whole BBC series about this.
No.
Judi Dench and trees. I am dying to see it.
Yeah. I kind of love, like, Liam Neeson as a tree in Monster Calls.
Oh, that's right. He is the tree.
No.
I thought you just meant in general, but yeah, right. Specifically, he did play the tree in Monster Calls.
So anyway, On Body and Soul is on Netflix. Yes. It is nominated for an Academy Award, which doesn't necessarily mean anything. However, I really like this.
Yeah, no, you've made me, y'all have sold me on it. I want to see it. I will see it. And the one I have seen that is opening in at least a few markets is the Chilean entry, A Fantastic Woman, from the director of Gloria, not the mob movie, but the one from a few years ago with Paulina Garcia as the middle-aged divorcee looking for love.
Yeah.
This one stars Daniela Vega as a woman who is involved with an older man, and they seem pretty happy, and then he dies, and suddenly she has to deal with his terrible wife and son, who are very awful to her, principally because of the fact that she's a trans woman, and they do all the awful stuff you're not supposed to do with trans people. They dead name her, they ask impertinent questions, they are generally gross and abusive, but Daniela Vega is a fantastic woman, or rather, the Marina, the character she plays, and
the film was originally not going to star her. She was going to be a consultant.
She was a consultant, right?
For the director,
but she is herself a trans woman,
and over time, yeah, she is transgender, and over time, he just said, oh, "Wait, you know what? You're it. You're my actress."
Yeah.
And
then shaped the character to accommodate, like, she's an opera singer, and you know.
Right. And I think she gives this really lovely muted performance, where I've read some criticism of her character's actions in the film as being sort of passive. But as I watched the film, I thought, well, she's numb from grief.
Yeah, this is a woman in mourning.
Her partner has been...
It's also like...
Just died.
It's dignified, her reactions. I mean, like, yeah. She's not going to... Like, they go low, she goes high kind of thing. You know, it's like...
Yeah.
And, like, there are a couple of explosive moments. I'm sure the clip that we'll see at the Oscars is her, like, climbing on the hood of the car and right. stomping on it, things like that.
And that's one of her...
The movie's built to that.
The movie has built to that scene where she's climbing on the car because she's finally... going to go after them
yeah.
in a way that they deserve. It is she remains in the face of their verbal abuse, and I must warn people, their physical abuse of her as
yeah.
well. I don't know if this film would be considered sort of triggering for a transgender audience member or not. It depends on you. But I know recently a trans friend of ours was physically attacked.
Yeah.
And this happened a couple months ago. And the people who did it are getting away with it. And so it is not, you know, it is not something that I think is used as a cheap plot device in the film.
No, no, not at all.
And I do want to say that if you are, you know,
sensitive,
very sensitive to this, know that that is something that takes place in this film.
Although also know that, like, I mean, how often do you get as sensitive a representation of, you know, the trans experience as you do here? So it's like, it's probably worth, you know,
perhaps
facing, you know, the tough stuff in this movie to see a movie that, like, you know, is this empathetic. And I think that that's the, you know, the thing that does feel really revolutionary about it is, you know, a movie that is not casting a cisgender you know,
correct
performer,
character, actor as you know, such a character. And the
it's also interesting that you have, like, you know, we expect in movies like this that, like, the when the police enter the picture, they're going to be completely, you know, heartless and obnoxious, and some of them are. But then you also have somebody who's trying to do the right thing and is causing a different set of problems, because you have this character who, you know, is a social worker and works with people on the street, and so she naturally assumes, oh, you must have been in an abusive relationship, right, or this guy must have taken advantage of you.
I know trans people, and therefore I know what your life is.
Yeah, and, right, and she's, yeah, like, no, it's good, we were in love, and he everything treated me well, fine, everything's, yeah, fine, you know, and so... So you see these sort of the two different faces of the bureaucracy and how they handle, you know, trans people.
Well, and he suffers a concussion that leads them to wonder whether, like, you know, yeah, to consider her a potential suspect.
He has an aneurysm and he falls downstairs.
Right, yeah. And so then they assume that they must have fought or something. And
right.
Yeah, it is, you know, I think I like this one a little better than Gloria, but in both cases they're very much... They're more about character than plot, I think, and it's really, you're following this woman's experience and her, you know, in the case of Gloria, just trying to sort of allow herself, or, you know, or figure out a way that she can find love again, you know, having been married, being of a certain age, and this is a woman who is just sort of like trying to weather this loss in her life, and then all these people who are trying to deprive her of her dignity while she is, right, just trying to mourn, you know, and trying, right, to get on with her life after this relationship. You know?
I mean, it's interesting how so much of what we see is, you know, part of an extension of the trans experience, the way that she's gay bashed and things like that. But, you know, there's also, I mean, I think this could happen to a cisgender woman. Like, I have a family friend who is 75 and married, you know, a 20-year, or not married, but had a relationship with a 20-year-old woman, and it drove this huge wedge into,
right,
his first marriage and his original kids and all this kind of stuff. And it's like, you know, that is a situation that, as longevity extends, all these kind of things comes up. And
yeah, she is the other woman as far as, like, the wife and the son are concerned.
Right.
But just the fact that. Yeah, and so, yeah, in that sense, you could see where they'd be like, oh, you can't come to the funeral and you can't da-da-da. But they use the fact that she's trans to sort of, like, dump all this other stuff on,
right,
her and, yeah, them and what their relationship was and, you know, how they're handling her and you know, whether or not they think she's going to, like, you know, steal everything in the apartment or whatever.
Right.
It's,
and that, you realize, like, rights are very still ambiguous when it comes to queer people in this world. And,
yes,
you know, there was another movie that was submitted for Oscar consideration that was not good at all, from South America, called Tamra, you know, that's about a man to woman trans experience that's about fighting to change your name. And
this is who eventually became, like, a member of parliament or
exactly,
something.
Exactly. Yeah. No. So the true story, I mean, it's a little bit like the Music of Silence, where the true story could be very interesting, but the kind of,
you would love a documentary on this subject.
Yeah.
And that
one, I think, did star a cisgender man as a trans woman. You know, so that was...
I'm not sure on that, because I saw it at the Santa Barbara Film Festival, where there was a trans person on stage, but it might have been
the real
woman. Yeah,
yeah. But yeah, no, I think Fantastic Woman is beautifully done. Danielle Vega is extraordinary, and, you know, I think people should see it.
Yeah.
You know, Gloria, he's, like, remaking Gloria himself in English. So.
Yes, with Julianne Moore, apparently.
So there are now going to be, like, four movies called Gloria, two of them remakes of the other.
and really, Proud Mary is also a remake of Gloria.
Is it?
Kind of,
okay,
figured out.
Also, yes, that is also true. Okay.
So for our DVD pick this week, we wanted to spotlight a film that is technically a Christmas movie, which I know y'all are sick of me hearing me talk about, and it's weird to bring up in February, but the circumstances by which this movie is available
it
merited, we thought, talking about it in February, because if you don't act now, you may not get it later.
Yeah, it's called Christmas Again.
Yeah, this is a movie that
we've talked about it a few times.
Yes, and I think it was up for something in the Spirit Awards a couple years ago, like someone to watch or one of those categories, and was available on Netflix for quite a while, and now is not. And the distributor Factory 25
is a tiny little distributor out of Brooklyn. They've made a limited edition DVD Blu-ray of the film. I don't know what number it is limited to, but knowing the distribution model of this group of folks, I can imagine not much.
Yeah, so it's quite possible that they will not be around by the time Christmas rolls around again. So we thought we would.
Yeah, you know. It is entirely possible that they'll sell through in a year.
Yeah.
You know, the copies they have. It comes in a beautiful sort of, you know,
recycled
hard cardboard container. It's very nice, and the movie's nice too. So yeah. You know, if you buy it now, you can only buy it through the Factory 25 website.
Yeah, we'll put a link on our Facebook page. But yeah, Kentucker Audley
is the guy who works in the Christmas tree lot, and he's sad.
Yes,
no, I remember this movie. It was at Locarno like a couple years ago, yeah. And it's a really good, tiny, sensitive, delicate American indie movie.
Very much so. And it's not a movie that I think you have to wait for Christmas to watch, because it is just really
really get into that good Christmas bummer mood you love so much.
It is a lovely sort of
it is a
melancholic but hopeful Christmas
Buy
story.
Buy it now. Wait until December.
Yeah. Just
when
hang
you're
on
really
to it.
Feeling like it's time for a good sadness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's like there are two kinds of like American indie movies. One is the kind of one where like the writers of 500 Days of Summer sit down and are like, what's a weird job? What about someone who works in a Christmas tree?
Yeah.
And then there's another that's like someone who like either did that himself or has, you know, looked at someone like that and thought, you know, that's what's that person's life like?
What are the ramifications of this?
The latter group. I mean, it finds the soul of that kind of thankless job.
It is decidedly unquirky, which is one of the best things about it. So yeah, Christmas Again, we'll have the Factory 25 link on the Facebook page. I very highly recommend it, and I am the king of Christmas. So. You've been told.
Past, present, and future.
That's right. Long may I reign. We have some lovely iTunes reviews that we wanted to share real quick.
Sure. We do. Let me find them for you.
Won't you?
Here they are.
How often does the expression around this house come up, Christmas again? Like, I can just imagine Dave asking that so many times.
I'll tell you.
Almost never.
Not that expression exactly, but January and February are me looking at him and saying, okay, Christmas is done. Christmas is over. We're going to put all these things away. You're going to calm down.
This week, the Method hand soap ran out. Frosted fir. That's when I know it's over, because everything has been packed away and put back in the closet, and I've taken all the Christmas songs out of my iPhone. And but the last holdout is finishing off that hand soap.
You come, you know, the day after Thanksgiving, he's like, ooh, Christmas hand soaps. You know, everything smells like piney, pine.
And Dave is like, Christmas again.
Oh, and Dave is mostly on the Christmas page with me. Don't get it twisted.
This is a year-long.
He's been looking at ornaments on eBay in the last couple of weeks.
This is like the time to get good prices on
that stuff. That is correct. Uh-huh. We buy like Christmas tree ornaments all year long from eBay.
Vintage cards.
I'm always hunting them down, looking for cool ones, because, you know, I love the really old unusual ones. And so, you know, that's not something you wait until the first week of December to start looking for.
You know, I broke a tradition this year, because I usually have like a Playmobil advent calendar every year. You know, and they come up with these really great elaborate ones. And like, I always think that Playmobil people are kind of dumb and stick figure-y, but like they have the most detailed animals. Mm-hmm. But I waited too late and was like trying to eBay it in November or something. And it's like, so what I'm going to do is this month buy my next year Playmobil calendar.
It's
no competition.
It pays to be prepared.
Yes. I always think about those, like the Lego and the different nativity calendars, or advent calendars. I haven't done that because I'm not a Lego person in general, but Like, this year I was very excited about getting the Ritter Sports chocolate advent calendar, mm-hmm. but they were all really tiny bites.
Oh, no.
And they, and none of them were, like, the flavors you want. Like, there was no cornflake in there. So, I don't know.
Listen, this...
There's a
this,
whiskey one.
This
you know,
year,
I'm not
we'll
that
just
much
buy
of a
25 cornflakes Ritter Sport bars and eat one every day.
That's make your own. Like,
yes. That's a great
Dave,
idea.
Dave, your job is to make Alonzo an advent calendar. You have 10 months, go.
No. We already have a friend who makes advent calendars out of ridiculous inside jokes.
Oh, that's true, yes.
And he is a genius at them. And so, you know, I don't even have to do that. We got
we had
one
that was, it was 25 Burlington Coat Factories that you opened up and saw Yoko Ono. Again, an inside joke. So.
Yeah, I don't get it.
This makes no
it
sense.
It takes too long to explain.
Anyone who lives outside of this house, but the repeated expression is not, I saw, is not Christmas again, it's, I saw Yoko Ono at Burlington Coat Factory.
It's the non sequitur to kill all non sequitur.
Yeah, yeah, yes. Uh-huh. Anyway.
Moving on.
It became an advent calendar. Now here are reviews of us. From iTunes.
From global iTunes.
From Tiger Rocks. I came across this podcast from my sister after she suggested I watch the YouTube series What the Flick. Over the past years, I've come to not only love that show, but I also rely heavily on watching it for recommendations for upcoming films. I fell in great like with Alonzo's great quips
Ooh.
About movies you shouldn't see. And I was amazed when I found out he was, in fact, married to the occasional guest on the show known as Dave White. Together, they are a force to be reckoned with.
Yeah.
And I look forward to hearing more about Dave's adventures in the nearby kitchen from their podcasting setup. Well, today's adventure involves queso in the slow cooker made with Rotel and Velveeta.
Mm-mm.
It's Super Bowl Sunday. And that is as far into Super Bowl as we get.
Yes. Well, the Kitten Bowl and the Puppy Bowl, but that's it.
Reaganing says, I enjoy listening to Dave and Alonzo talk about movies, but their digressions into food are wonderful.
Hey, go to patreon.com/linoleumknife and get Linoleum Knife and Fork, a weekly show we do that's all food.
Yeah.
It's a food podcast hosted by two film critics.
Yes.
You can also get LKTV, Linoleum Nights, lots of fun prizes. So yeah, if you want more content from us, patreon.com/linoleumknife.
Coming soon, the crazy pet surgery spinoff show. Like my cat's hip replacement.
Like
in
this
episode.
The three of us can work. We can
I was
going to
say, I write this down. I like it.
Sometimes they have cool guests, too, such as today.
Yes, for instance.
Thanks, David Alonzo, for telling me about Romanian cinema and recommending their finest.
You're welcome.
This is from Sing It Back. I discovered Alonzo during his guest spot on Pop Rocket.
Oh, yay.
I enjoyed his takes on pop culture and his charming sense of humor enough to follow him back to his own podcast. I'm so happy I did. Alonzo and Dave are fantastic. I really love this podcast, and I'm glad to have it in my regular pod lineup.
Oh.
You know, Alonzo and I used to do the Rotten Tomatoes show. And
oh, I missed that.
I would go in, and I would be kind of like fumbly. And Alonzo would come in, and like Oscar Wilde would be like, zing, zang, zong. Like, I mean, he would just nail the movies in like three hilarious sound bites, and I'd be like, how does he do that?
That's very sweet of you. Thank you. I just went to a thing down at the LA Center Studios. I was like, oh, Rotten Tomatoes show.
Someone else who found us on Pop Rock.
Oh, cool.
Call Me Bryce Lee.
Mm-hmm.
I became acquainted with them when they served as guest hosts on Pop Rocket. What I like most about Linoleum Knife is that you don't have to be a huge moviegoer to appreciate the podcast. They are legitimate film critics. thank you.
We don't hear that enough.
So it is fun to hear their opinions on the films I watch, as well as their commentary on films I never knew existed or have zero desire to watch.
Did you know that at Variety, legitimate means
the theater.
Live theater?
Yes.
So a legitimate critic and a film critic are two totally different things.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you're right.
Linoleum Knife is like a bowl of grandma's chicken soup on a cold winter's day.
Oh.
Thank you. I could be having an infinitely crappy day at work, but the moment I hear Alonzo's hypnotic baritone and Dave's rich bass, my gray skies instantly become blue.
Who wrote this?
We're gonna, look, the cookie bouquet is on its way. Bryce.
Oh, that's still Bryce. Oh, yeah. Okay, cool.
That's it.
All right. Well,
other than one that just says, I love these guys, that's from Jose in Chile.
All right.
So well, now we have someone listening in Chile.
And I bet he's hopefully has seen a Fantastic Woman. Well, thank you guys for that. We always appreciate positive reviews on iTunes. We'll happily read them if you leave us a nice 5-star review.
5 stars.
On Apple Podcasts. Peter, where can people find you online?
Variety.com and on Twitter at AskDeBruges.
D-E-B-R-U-G-E. So yeah, thank you all for listening. You can also hear me, speaking of Pop Rocket, on the Maximum Fun show Who Shot Ya? That drops every Friday with Ricky Carmona and April Wolf. And you can follow this program on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at LinoleumCast. Again, our Patreon page is patreon.com/linoleumknife. Thank you, Blue, for our theme music. You can, in addition to Apple Podcasts, you can stream us and leave positive feedback for us there in all of the streaming places like Spotify and Stitcher Radio and TheLounge.com and CastBox and Podbean and iVoox, which is really a thing. It's all in Spanish. I don't know what the deal is, but we're on it. You can drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com with questions or comments. And yeah. We thank you all for listening. Peter, thank you, as always, for coming in. It's always a treat to have you. And we will catch you guys next week. So until then.
Goodbye.